when it becomes Christian literary art, it's because it's in service of those deep, profound truths which often emerge from those interior or subterranean spaces within the soul. And those spaces and that reading and that writing coalesce and trigger what I think Newman calls the illative sense, that instinct within us, that impulse within us that gestures towards the transcendence, or at least to a higher or a deeper or certainly richer sense of meaning.
Darren Middleton is professor of literature and theology at Baylor University, where he is also director of Baylor's interdisciplinary core. This year, he also assumed the editorship of the academic journal Christianity and Literature, a leading journal in the field of literature and religion. A prolific scholar with books on subjects ranging from the novelist Shusaku Endo, Graham Greene, and Cormac McCarthy, to studies of the Rastafari, Darren is also an authority on Christian popular fiction, especially historical fiction. We discuss today his book, The Rider and the Cross, a collection of interviews with authors of Christian historical fiction, as well as his views on the field of religion and literature. I'm Matthew Ickman of BYU's Faith and Imagination Institute. Okay, Darren, so you and I have been trying to set up this podcast recording for some time now, but you recommended to me this podcast a few years ago by our mutual friend Van Gessel, who's my former dean. So I'm actually a few years late to the conversation. I apologize. But I've got to say, I'm grateful that I am late, because there are several things I want to talk to you about, including your work as the new editor of the academic journal Christianity and Literature, which we would not have discussed a couple of years ago before your editor. So even though I'm late, I'm glad for the timing. Before we get to that, I want to ask you, though, about the arc of your career as a teacher and scholar, and especially about a book that you published a couple of years ago on the subject of Christian historical fiction. So let me begin briefly with the path that you've taken to your current academic position at Baylor University, where you're a professor of literature and theology, and you also serve as the director of the Baylor Interdisciplinary Core. As listeners may detect from your accent, you're not a Texas native, but you've spent now much of your working life in Texas, as you taught at Texas Christian University for, was it 24 years before coming to Baylor? And I've got to ask, did you ever envision yourself settling down in Texas?
Well, thank you, first of all, Matthew, for having me. Yes, a good friend of mine told me a long, long time ago, did you ever think that you would move from the city of dreaming spires, since I had some graduate work in Oxford, to Jerusalem on the Brazos, as they refer to Waco? And no, I did not. I thought, since my wife is from Memphis, that I would spend a lot of my time in Tennessee. And I did. I spent 5 years there. But the South and the Southwest have been home to me now for, I think, 28 years and counting. I'm one of those individuals who feels that you can be happy or unhappy anywhere. And I'm very happy in Waco. I'm very happy that I've spent some time in the South and in the Southwest. The culture is just fantastic. It's a home to natural-born storytellers, everyone from Eudora Welty to Waylon Jennings, and I enjoy all points in between.
Nice. Yeah, we've actually had another Baylor scholar on a few years ago, Heidi Hornick, who's an art historian and does all kinds of great work. I love Heidi. So it's great to have you on here, Darren. Thank you so much. Let me ask you about your CV or your academic resume. It lists this remarkably wide variety of publications. I mean, so for example, you published books on the writings of the Japanese novelist Shusaku Endo and the English novelist Graham Greene. You've written about literature's relationship with theology. You've written about the Rastafari. Is there a connecting thread between these diverse interests, or are they simply the product of a curious and wide-ranging mind?
Reading, to me, reading is an amazingly humanizing force, it seems to me. And there's been a lot of work in recent years, from Jessica Houghton Wilson all the way through to George Saunders, about fiction's ability to foster mental migration and imaginative empathy. And even the late Pope Francis only last year published an encyclical that talks about the importance of literature in spiritual formation. My mind is a bit of a search engine, I'll admit, and I try to read as widely as I can. Yet I think there is a golden thread running through my work, and I think it would be something like this. It's the theme of believing skepticism. I'm very drawn to religious nonconformists, the kind of authors and characters that Reynolds Price used to call saintly outlaws. These are the individuals who kind of prowl at the edges of belief and unbelief. They see faith and doubt as vital and necessary concomitants in a healthy Christian discipleship. And so Endo and Green and Kazantzakis and Cormac McCarthy, all of them belong to what I would call the tribe of Thomas the Doubter. And I count myself among that dodgy crowd. So that's where I stand. And I think that's where my work has tried to go across the years.
That's fascinating. Have you believing skepticism or religious outlaws? That already sounds like it would be an amazing book. Have you written actually a book on that subject itself?
So the closest I ever came to that, Matt, was a book that I published in 2009 on Nikos Kazantzakis and Christian theology. And its title, which steals a line from Leonard Cohen's song Hallelujah, and the line about a broken hallelujah, tried to capture something of Kazantzakis's own nonconformism. He was more Eastern Orthodox or Greek Orthodox than the Greek Orthodox would imagine him to be, and he was refused an Orthodox burial when he died in 57. But my own attempt to rehabilitate him theologically shows that he has far more theological sources and norms going on in his work than people give him credit for. So he's a good saintly outlaw.
Yeah, okay, good. I do find it interesting that, he that the book that he published years ago, The Last Temptation of Christ, which made it into a movie, and then you had Martin Scorsese, right, who did the Endo film Silence. And Scorsese is a very fine Catholic, but that a very fine Catholic also made, kind of the film Taxi Driver and, Raging Bull. There's a tension in there which is not lost on many a commentator.
True. Scorsese is just one of the art form's great geniuses, it seems to me. Fully in love with the art form of cinema, in encyclopedic mind when it comes to the great film directors and the great films of the last century and beyond. But also someone with a deep reverence and a deep faith, as you know.
Yeah, that's right. Very much so. At what point, so do you identify as a scholar of literature and religion? And if so, have you found a community in the field? Is there even a definable field that you could call a field of literature and religion? Or do you feel that you were or you still are, that all that, kind of hover around these subjects toil somewhat alone?
I first came to the subject of literature and theology or literature and religion in the early 1990s. I was finishing my work at Christ Church, Oxford, with Maurice Wiles and Rowan Williams and Paul Phidias, who Paul was a great Baptist scholar of theology and literature. And I realized at the time that most of my conversation partners, at least intellectually and spiritually, were novelists, were poets, and short story writers. And at that point, although I had the opportunity to stay on in Oxford, I decided to travel north to the University of Glasgow in Scotland to work with David Jasper, who I think is one of the great voices in our discipline. At the time, I felt not so much alone. I mean, I was able to draw sustenance from characters like John Henry Newman, who, of course, Christchurch is close to Oriel. He was a tutor there, but then he left and holed himself up at the College of Littlemore before he converted to Catholicism. A little known fact is that the first book he wrote after 1845 at Littlemore, so the first book he wrote after he became Catholic was in fact a novel called Loss and Gain, which I reread again this summer as I took my students to the College of Littlemore and spent some time there shortly after he was made a Doctor of the Church. So that was nice and poetic. But at the time, I didn't feel so much alone. I knew there were journals there. I knew there were regional and national and international conferences. The field was becoming more and more sophisticated, and I was very fortunate to find myself in good company through David and others, with scholars who that I had lively and spirited conversations with, and they were somewhat intrigued by my early attempts to sort of play around with Kazantzakis's theology.
I bet they were. That's great. Let me turn that. In fact, let me turn to this book that you published a couple of years ago, which I really enjoyed reading. It's called The Writer on the Cross, Interviews with Authors of Christian Historical Fiction. I have a couple of questions here for you at the outset. One is about the subject matter, the Christian historical fiction, and about what drew you to it. And the other is about the format, the printed interview with authors of these novels. And I'm wondering why you take this approach to the subject instead of a standard treatment by way of, say, literary criticism.
So this Christian historical fiction book came out largely, during COVID, actually, and when we were all in lockdown. And I do a lot of field work for my study of the Rastafari, and that wasn't something I was able to do at that particular time. So I turned my direction towards Christian historical fiction, knowing that I'd had some success over the years in not just in the undergraduate setting, but also in adult Christian education workshops, Sunday schools. Success teaching elements of Christian history through fiction. Sometimes the folk that I found in undergraduates, but also lifelong learners in adult Christian education settings, found your standard primary sources in theology somewhat intimidating. And frankly, anyone who picks up Thomas Aquinas is likely to feel intimidated. And so they would often come to me and say, what would you recommend? And I found myself, as much as it probably is a heresy to anyone who's a scholar of Thomas Aquinas, I would say, then why don't you start with a novel about Thomas Aquinas? Learn a little bit about his life, because his life is inextricably intertwined with his theology. And many of them did that, came back to me, and it gave me the idea, because they so enjoyed what they were doing, it gave me the idea of setting up a book that would admittedly sort of paint with broad brushstrokes. It kind of had 12 chapters in there, four sections, three chapters per section, each section looking at a major chunk of Christian history, starting with the patristics, going through the Middle Ages, the Reformation, post-Reformation, and then going into modernity. Picking three novelists, three authors and three novels, and then engaging in interviews, which are I was able to conduct over Zoom, over email, and over telephone, and then to put that together in a transcript and then share that with the author and then have some more questioning. It was just a fun experience to put that together. And I wrote it with the classroom in mind, because teaching is a cornerstone of my scholarship, always has been, always will be.
Okay, a couple of things that you said that really stand out to me about this book and its origins. One, that it came about during COVID. At least that was kind of the inception of the idea. Because is that reaching out to the authors themselves and not kind of like just working alone in your head with kind of writing criticism about it. That there is something kind of that's social about the very nature of the way the book even got composed, which I like, and that it's a good COVID exercise, and also the connection. With the classroom, as you mentioned, but beyond that, I mean, you said you have experience with Sunday schools and the like and church communities. And so that there is kind of a public dimension also to the work, which is where a lot of this work goes. I mean, this fiction in here was not written solely for scholars, right? It's written for a much wider reading public, kind of a educated non-specialists.
True. And I think it's, but it's also, it has some scholars in mind. I mean, I was trained, as I'm sure you were, Matt, at a time when we were all told that the author is dead. In some sense, what that often led to was, well, yeah, the author is dead, and that means that the interpretive ego lives on, right? The literary critic becomes supremely important if the author is dead. Right. And I had a sneaking suspicion, which this experience kind of confirmed, that the authors of these fictions were every bit as fascinating as the lives they were trying to tell, albeit imaginatively and theologically. And that was borne out by some of the conversations that I had. You know, there were some really interesting folk who, Sarah Borman, for example, wanted to write and did write a novel about Martin Luther's Reformation. She read widely. She read books about Luther. She went back to the primary sources, but most of all, and I think it comes across quite nicely in her interview, she earthed herself in her Lutheran congregation. I mean, these authors were not the literary equivalent of method actors who immerse themselves into their subject, but they're pretty close. They managed to find as much information as they could, but they also lived in lively, vibrant church communities. So yes, I do think there's a public-facing character to the work that I'm trying to do. And it was a real joy to connect with these folk at a time when most of us were feeling disconnected.
Absolutely. I love that. And by the way, the reference there to the how we got trained back in our day, the author is dead. It's kind of paraphrased Dostoevsky. If the author is dead, then all interpretations are permitted, right? You know? Okay. Yeah, we've seen a lot of that over many years. Let me ask you about going back to the book. So, in your introduction to the book, right, you remarked that Christian art helps us explore what faith involves and what it means to embody that faith. And I'm wondering what that means relative to Christian literary art, right? Because exploration of faith in that context proceeds not only from subject matter, but also from craft, right? You know, so the quality of what's being written, and it's also a function of genre, right? You know, so short story is a different kind of a genre than, say, a novel would be, which is different again from lyric poems and so on and so forth. When you come across a work of Christian historical fiction that you really like, is it the same experience that you have when you read a work of literature that is not religious in its subject matter? I mean, do you find yourself focusing in the same way on matters of craft and genre when you get to Christian historical fiction? Or is it a different experience for you? You know, so that what makes liking a work of Christian literary art different from liking a work of literary art generally?
I think there's a like and an unlike aspect to my answer here. The process is similar and yet different, is what I mean. Wherever I pick up a piece of literary art, I'm looking for everything that a good reader should be looking for in good literature, and that is, of course, astute characterization, a subtle deployment of tropes, so the artistry and the style matters. I'm looking for compelling plot, for suggestive themes, and an overall kind of felicitous telling of the story. That grabs me every time. Ian McEwan, for example, is not a particularly religious writer. In fact, actually, I think he's quite militantly opposed to religion from everything that I've read in his nonfiction. But I devour everything he writes because he ticks all of the boxes in that checklist. And there's a felicitous telling of the story, whatever it's about, in Ian McEwan, and the list could go on. Same thing with Graham Swift, who's latest I'm reading. But when it becomes Christian literary art, it's because it's in service of those deep, profound truths which often emerge from those interior or subterranean spaces within the soul. And those spaces and that reading and that writing coalesce and trigger what I think Newman calls the illative sense, that instinct within us, that impulse within us that gestures towards the transcendence, or at least to a higher or a deeper or certainly richer sense of meaning. And it also sort of in some fiction, not in all, if all those things are present and then this magic something else happens, and that I rather like Hanso von Balthasar's notion of the aesthetic arrest. And Bishop Barron does a lot with this, of course. It goes into your soul. The reading and the writing goes into your soul, and it reorients who you are as a person. Now, of course, the Gospels are like this. They're literature too, on one sense. And I'll never forget being in a state school in England and reading the Gospel of Mark for the first time. It's a weird, weird gospel. And it's strange and it's dark, and Jesus is enigmatic and puzzling. But underneath all of that is this tremendous light and hope and buoyancy and vibrancy. And I just remember being arrested by all of that. And then, of course, Balthazar's line, and again, Bishop Barron makes much of this, the aesthetic arrest triggers a sense of mission. You have to tell other people about this, which is why I'm forever recommending Cormac McCarthy's The Road and Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, and the list goes on, of course. And, you know, literature facilitates that kind of spiritual openness to the voice with a uppercase V that speaks through multiple and diverse voices with a lowercase V throughout the world. God is in all things, and in that sense, my imagination at least tries to be sacramental.
That's a brilliant description. That's fantastic. I'm gonna keep that and use that actually in classes that I teach. That was really fantastic, Darren. Thank you so much. And that kind of response, though, from you is the product of somebody who's done a lot of thinking about these things and a lot of reading and has synthesized a lot of material, which I guess gets me to this question right here. I was struck in the book by how often you know, clearly a wide reader, a search engine of a reader, as you put it, right? How often you'd ask the authors how widely they'd read on historical figures about whom they were writing. And some of them had read quite widely, right? As you point out with Sarah Bowman. Others, it seemed that they would reply that they'd done some reading, but not all that much. It's kind of more the method acting approach in a way. They kind of imagine themselves into scenarios. It was kind of an Ignatian exercise in a way. I've imagined themselves back in the lives of those about whom they were writing without doing a tremendous amount of reading. Few have done the reading as widely as you have. Do you find in reading this work, Christian Historical Fiction, that there is a correlation between the amount an author reads in this field and the quality of the work they produce?
Sometimes. Carolyn Coleman O'Neill's book or novel, Loving Sorin, which is a fantastic fictional portrayal of what is a particularly sad episode in Soren Kierkegaard's life, where he breaks off his engagement with Regin Olsen. Loving Sorin is all of the things that I said about good literature, astute characterization, philosophers, telling of the story, but it's rooted in some very meticulous research. Carolyn took herself over to the Danish West Indies, combed through the archives, mined all the resources that were available, and I think that shows in the way she approaches her fiction. But as I indicated a little earlier, with someone like Sarah Bowman, she did her reading. One would have to do some Christian historical fiction. But she's also earthed in her Lutheran congregation. And here's what I've always tried to have an openness for, Matt. People on the ground are often, at least religiously speaking, people on the ground are often far more complicated and multi-layered than some of the books would have them be. And I'm going to credit my lovely wife, who's an American religious historian, who... she knows I'm fascinated in the American religious landscape as an outsider, although I've been here for over 30 years, so I guess I'm an insider now. She knows I'm fascinated by it, but she'd be the first person to tell me, yes, you can read, here's some books I would recommend that you read on American religion, its history and its patterns and themes and trajectories and so on and so forth. But really, people on the ground are a lot more complicated than those textbooks will teach you, which is why she does a lot of oral histories in her work. And when you get down on the ground with those people, you realize that their theologies, their theological reflection is very often, not always, but very often forged on the hard anvil that we call life. You know, it comes out of not just rational reflection or the ability to exist in an ivory tower or an air-conditioned library and to reflect on the logical exactitude of what it is we believe and so on and so forth. It wells up from the very source of who they are, from what Kazantzakis would call the very pit of their entrails. It's visceral. It's human. That's what it is.
I think that's beautiful. Yeah, I agree. You know, something I've felt this always. I mean, I've been a scholar now for, I guess, this is my 26th year and beginning of BYU. I've plus 6 years of PhD program, but it's about 30 years now I've been at this, and something that's always moved me just in religious communities. People express their convictions. Is the profundity of that conviction hitting kind of like the thick texture of a lived experience, actual life? People's conviction and circumstance. And when you find people in out of the midst of that who have the capacity for being able to sort of imagine stories and tell them well, there's a gift in that, both a talent in the sense of a capacity to sort of speak, to write, to frame stories, but also a gift. There's a sense of being able to sort of identify things that are of particular ultimate significance and being able to express that, that I always find moving in simple quotidian circumstances of every week worship, say. There are a lot of that comes across inside the authors here in this book. You can tell many are well read, but most are deeply situated in these communities, which I appreciate you bringing out. That really communicates itself in the work and in your questions that you put to them and the ways they responded to your questions in the book, which I love.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask about the structure of the book. You mentioned already the structure, and I'm going to just kind of repeat it for listeners here. Four parts, three chapters each, so 12 chapters in the book, and you're moving through time historically. So you begin with the patristics, you know, kind of mid-5th century to Middle Ages, and then you go to the Middle Ages, rather, and then to the Renaissance. Actually, let me back up. I'm looking here at the table of contents. The patristics from circa 100 to 451, then the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, so 500 to 1500, about 1,000 years there. Then a Reformation and Post-Reformation, 1500 to 1750, and then the modern period from 1750 to the present day. To me, that read very well. I liked it. But there were, of course, choices that you might have made. You might have just given us the 12 greatest hits, you know, according to Darren Middleton. Why go historically through time that way and not simply one wide reader's 12 favorites?
I think the simple answer to that is to reference what I was saying a little earlier. Teaching is the cornerstone of my scholarship. And long before I even put this book together, I thought about teaching a course in an adult Christian education context where I could take folk who are intimidated by theology, who perhaps have dipped into, let's say, The Cost of Discipleship by Dietrich Bonhoeffer, found it powerful and tender and moving, but then they move to something like Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion and they're all lost at sea. And they needed some guidance. The first thing that I told them, of course, in the class, before they even read any fiction, was, look, you're all theologians. The point is, how do you become a good one? and part of that involves mining the Christian tradition. And this, you know, here's where my theology comes out of my autobiography. I'm the fourth born son of a coal miner who quarried the English East Midlands. And there's something about, I never followed my father down the mine. I was much too bookish for that. But the way he toiled down there for 35 years stayed with me. And that's translated into a trope. I talk about quarrying and mining the Christian tradition, mining the rich seams of that tradition and of that heritage, and of helping undergraduates, as well as those in adult Christian education settings, to realize that they have the ability to enter into and then mine those seams. They don't have all the right or the so-called proper instruments to do that just yet. Maybe those primary sources are intimidating. But let's start with a novel. Fiction is a good, often neutral vantage point from which to gather. Everybody goes to a book club, most people do. You know, just to discuss some of the ideas as well as the life of the individuals who produce those ideas. It's been very helpful. So the scheme is somewhat arbitrary, and on one level you could say, well, you've got 12 chapters, which is charmingly biblical, but it's also theological in the sense that I'm trying to move through these four major epochs or eras and then whet the appetite of people as they work their way through the book. But yeah, I did make some choices. There's a whole cottage industry of novels about Thomas Aquinas, for example. And while I do have one in there, there's an example. I also try to balance that with other theologians from that period who would get some of the folk in my adult Christian education workshops thinking about the diversity of theology in, let's say, the medieval period, because we sometimes tend to think that the medieval period is largely, well, that's it's Aquinas, it's Anselm, it's Bonaventure, it's Abelard, and they all have one thing in common, right? They're all male. Well, there's an interesting collection of female theologians at this time, and increasingly you're seeing more and more novels written about them, novels about Marjorie Kemp, novels about Julian of Norwich, Marjorie's about Hildegard von Bingen, who of course is one of the doctors of the church. I'm glad for that, and I wanted to put those novels in front of the readers as much as some of the major makers, the so-called major makers and remakers of Christian doctrine, like Aquinas and like Calvin.
Okay, I'm glad you did put them in there, because I actually read one of those novels. The novel on Hildegard von Bingen by Mary, is it Sherratt or Sherratt? How do you say her name?
Sherratt, Mary Sherratt.
Yeah, I read that novel as an example. I began reading one. I'm halfway through the novel by Joan Mueller or Mueller on St. Francis of Assisi. So thank you for getting me turned on to those novels.
Sure.
So just to give the listeners a feel for the book, can I read you maybe two passages, maybe three from the book, and you share your thoughts about those passages? Yeah. And the first one is toward the end of the book. It's from Regina Doman, who wrote the text of a graphic novel about Pope Francis. And here's what she writes. And I think I found this a provocative observation, so I don't want to get your thoughts on it. Here's what she writes. There's no conflict between becoming a great writer and becoming a great saint. Both involve understanding the human person, and both involve befriending many, many different people and learning to love them, particularly people who are not like yourself in race, age, culture, or sex. Both involve a profound self-awareness and honesty and a willingness to take risk, and both involve sacrifice and the cultivation of an inner life that includes God. Any writer who is truly honest will admit that God is a part of his or her creative process.
Lovely, lovely quote. Regina was a fascinating author to speak with. Her life, every bit as fascinating as the life she's actually drawing attention to. And of course, as you note, she's putting together a graphic novel about Pope Francis. She is Catholic, so that comment is fully illustrative of her Catholic sacramental and literary imagination, her ability to see God in all things and in all processes, some semblance of God. Is precisely the kind of porousness and generosity of spirit that is often needed in a good writer, it seems to me. I'm struck by, you know, the opening line about the saints. You know, it kind of reminds me when she first made that comment to me, what popped into my head was the line at the end of Bananas' novel, The Woman Who Was Poor, when the final line says something along the lines of, the only real misery is that we're not all saints, right? And there is something about how that's actually what the Christian existence is all about. It's the story of how we move from being sinners to becoming saints, to becoming conformed to Christ. And so there's something of that buried in what she's actually saying. But she's also playing up, it seems to me, the importance of being human. And that makes me think of the Roman poet and playwright Terence with his famous line, "Nothing human is uninteresting to me," which I've always carried with me and probably explains why I try to read as widely as I do and think as widely as I do as well. Nothing human is uninteresting to me either.
Yeah, bravo. Love it. Thank you. Here's one also from Tim J. Young, who writes about St. Athanasius. He writes, "I think it is hard to visualize a history of Christianity in which the formulators of Christian thinking and teaching would not have done such a thing as exploring the relation between Greek philosophy and their own approach to reality and living. If Christianity had been an insular, inward-looking religion, then perhaps early Christians could have escaped confronting other systems and ways. But thanks to Jesus' command to go out and Paul's mission to the Gentiles, it wasn't. Any religion that proposes the obligation to engage others will inevitably be changed by how others think and how they live."
Yeah, that's in Latin, of course, we would call that the ad extra or approach, the missionizing impulse, which goes all the way back to the Apostle Paul, which Tim picks up on. It's the Acts 17 impulse where Paul, of course, as you know, comes into Athens and he notices that the tomb of the unknown God or the temple to the unknown God, the statue, the monument. And he gets to Mars Hill and then he finally sort of acknowledges you Athenians are very religious. That's the hook on which he then hangs the garment of the gospel. He quotes from the Greek poets. He recognizes there's something in the wider culture, and if we can use the best of it to promote the gospel, that's a good thing. That's a sound apologetic and evangelical tool or strategy. So I think Tim's picking up on that. I think he's also recognizing an impulse that comes out of the Pope's encyclical Pope Francis's encyclical last year on the role of literature in Christian formation, where the Pope Francis says, when we fall into the temptation of elevating what he calls our cultural historical grammar to and think of it as the final or the only vocabulary of faith, then we actually damage or cheapen the richness and the depth of the gospel. And we tend to think of our own particular vocabulary of faith, our own specific story of salvation in our neck of the woods, in our part of the world. That's when we run into some trouble. If we can listen to other voices that are out there, we stand a chance to hear in the midst of those voices, the voice that speaks through us all, and that is God, of course.
Amen to that. And this podcast, for example, is ecumenical, and I encounter so many extraordinary thinkers and deeply, deeply inspired persons in talking with. I mean, today, things you said, Darren, I'm brilliant. And it makes me richer and better. And it's sad that we live in a moment, it seems to me, our own cultural moment, social moment right now, is one where many, not just Christians, but people from all walks of life seem to be hardened into sort of tribal ways of thinking, where they just, those who are outside the tribe have nothing to say to them. And the tribes get narrower and narrower. And it makes me worried about not only how we close off from each other, but how we close ourselves off also from the God who might speak through others to us and open our minds in ways that would make us just better human beings and better able to care for others as well as for our own.
True, true. I think that's very true. And it was only this week that I actually heard a study saying that fewer and fewer Americans are actually reading for fun. I have to believe that reading enlarges our sympathies and our appreciation for the other and for difference. There are lots of places where you could start civic engagement, just service, volunteer work that would introduce you to other people, other voices, other rooms, as it were. But reading will do that as well, particularly if it fosters the right kind of mental migration and facilitates the right kind of imaginative empathy, then hopefully it's a short step from finding characters that are other than ourselves and developing some sympathy for them and the way they move through their world, albeit a fictional world. It's a short step from that to developing an ethic where you move through the so-called real world in a similar kind of fashion with charity and with empathy.
Beautiful. That on that note, I'll be one more passage. This one from Sarah Bowman, who we've talked about a little bit already today, and she writes about Luther, as you've mentioned, and I love this, and it kind of punctuates what we've been talking about a bit here in this conversation, Darren. She writes, "Something I love about fiction, writing in general, and even life, is the Holy Spirit's tendency to take what we do and bring so much more out of it. Writing as a Christian with that ever-present commission to witness to God's works in Christ Jesus can be incredibly intimidating. But knowing that I'm not doing it all under my own power is as comforting as the task can be intimidating. As with all vocations, God transforms the ordinary and mundane into something sacred."
I really thrum to the song that she's singing there. I mean, it's a hymn to epiphanies and illuminations and breakthroughs and how, yeah, there is something sublime. I think George Eliot calls it the mystery beneath the real, that that is able to take the ordinary, the so-called mundane and the customary, and make it open out into something truly amazing and extraordinary, certainly something richer or deeper and higher maybe than ourselves, certainly higher than our own limited perspective on the world. And so it's James Joyce in his short stories, or it's Carol Shields in her novels, who take ordinary people and by dint of superb characterization and you know, an amazing use of symbolism, are able to transform them into spectacular characters that function, if we let them, as like mirrors that we hold up to ourselves, our own ordinariness. And most of us, as George Eliot said, right, at the end of Middlemarch, most of us lead kind of ordinary lives and will finally be put to rest in unvisited tombs. She said, it's a rather dark ending, but it's actually quite true. It's realistic. Most of us, you know, lead ordinary lives, but the growing good of the world, she says, is largely dependent upon unhistoric acts. And that's why there's so much good between people. We do those ordinary things that open out into extraordinariness.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Making the transition here, Stan, we have a few minutes left here. I want to talk to you, but let me ask you about the journal Christianity Literature, if I may. You became the editor of that beginning of this year. For those who aren't familiar with that journal, it's one of the landmark journals in the field of literature and religion. And when the announcement first circulated and you learned that the journal was looking for a new editor, this is just a question for you, Darren. Did you want to apply or did that inclination come later? Were you coerced to apply? How'd this work?
No one coerced me, but the inclination did come later. I had served actually with Eric Zulkowski as a U.S. editor for literature and theology for just over a decade in the early 2000s, and very much enjoyed that experience. David Jasper was the editor at the time. It changed editorship, went to Eric, and Eric and I had a fun time being part of that journal, which is also one of the three main journals in our field. But I did not reach out and apply. I thought about it, and if I'm honest, there was a certain anxiety of influence. Mark Eaton is matchless, and I wouldn't want to follow in his footsteps, and yet here I am. And that's largely because I had some good conversations with Mark and with others as well, and I thought long and hard about what was good about the journal and what had pulled me in. It's one of the few journals that I have subscribed to for many, many years. I'm profoundly committed to what it does. And I celebrate the best of what it does, but there's some new things I think that we can do. There's some new and emerging voices out there, both from the standpoint of literature, but also from the standpoint of literary criticism as well. Does the world need another article on Flannery O'Connor? Yeah, it does. It does, I think. But I think there's also room for some other underserved or underrepresented writers who are telling us something, let's say, about the character of the global church. We live in a world where 1 in 3 Christians are African. And so those of us who have a dog in the hunt here, if we want to learn something about the future of our faith, then we can do a lot worse than look at the continent of Africa. And then more specifically, to look at some of the African writers who are wrestling with some of the trends and trajectories within African Christianity, or to look at some of those who are writing Christian historical fictions, let's say. There's a fantastic novel by B.A. Bendale called Yoruba Boy Running, which is about a historicizing of the life of Samuel A.J. Crowther, who anybody who studies West African Christianity has to study Crowther. It's a fantastic novel and would be a good one to introduce to students who would find that part of the world somewhat enigmatic and hard to get into, but it's a fantastic novel. So I applied and got over my anxiety of influence, and here I am. And so I'm very much eager to see special issues. I'd like to see at least one a year that tackles or addresses some topics that have not appeared in the pages of Christianity and literature in the past. Some of the special issues that have occurred recently have been really fascinating ones. I hope to do more of that. There's plenty of good work out there. So for good or ill, hopefully, I'll leave the journal in a much better place by the time I step down after my tour of duty is over.
I'm a big fan of the work Mark Eaton did. I think he was great. But when I saw that you were the incoming editor, I cheered because I also subscribe to the journal. I love the journal. I want to see it thrive. And Mark had done such great work there, Mark and his team. I was worried when I saw the announcement go out about the new editor. Right? I thought, oh boy, please, let it be a good editor. I was delighted, Darren, that you had, first of all, the internal compulsion to apply and that they had the good judgment to appoint you. I thought that was very, very pleasing to me. What you say about... So I'm an incoming editor of a journal, not one of the three main ones in the field, but the Journal of Literature and Belief. And we also have some special issues that we're going to getting put together that I'm very excited about. That'll take a year, 2 years to come out in print, but that are going to be, I think, really good. And I also resonate with what you said. I mean, does the world need one more article about Flannery O'Connor? And I like that you said, well, yes, but. I mean, I think was it Jamie Smith, James K. Smith? I read recently... He wrote somewhere, it was on Substack, he said, I'm tired of reading about Flannery O'Connor. I think that a lot of people in the field of literature and religion see a lot of the same people brought forward again and again and again. And there's a reason why they're there, right? And without detracting from that, there's expanding the canon out the way you want to, I think will be all to the good. And including, you know, you mentioned Africa, global world or other genres. And also, you know, teasing out those aspects of you know, sort of Christian religious thought that appear in surprising places. I know that there's an article we're going to have publishing in Literature and Belief about the story collection, The Things They Carry by Tim O'Brien, which is not on the surface at all a religious body of work, but it has these themes running through it that the author teased out that I thought was really brilliant. So anyway, I love your vision for it, and that's fantastic.
It's funny you should say that, Matt, because the September issue of literature of Christianity and Literature is actually going to feature an essay on that very novel by that very author as well. So,
okay,
without realizing there is some kind of synchronicity between the kind of work that our respective journals are doing. So good. I like that.
Yeah, let's call it inspiration. It makes me feel better than like being late, right? So, okay. Yeah. Let me conclude the discussion here. This has been a great conversation. Thank you so much, Darren. Let me conclude it here with this question for you. It's back to where we kind of started with your own arc and your own career. In your own writing, do you ever think of writing some kind of opus? That will weave together the various threads of your diverse scholarly interests. I'd mentioned, you know, this book on, you know, kind of believing skepticism or whatever. Or instead, you just think in terms of setting yourself to the next thing that needs doing. If someone told the story of your scholarly life based on the next book you write, what's the story they're telling?
That's a really good question, Matt. I have it in mind to write a book on faith and doubt, and therefore believing skepticism, Tribe of Thomas stuff, from George Eliot through to Octavia Butler, with some sidebars on D.H. Lawrence, R.S. Thomas, maybe Kazantzakis and Endo and Green, others as well, maybe. Again, the golden thread would be that believing skepticism, which I would always want to trace to scripture. I'd always want to say my favorite book in the Bible is the book of Ecclesiastes. Because Koheleth, for me, is a believing skeptic. And in one sense, it's the most modern or the most contemporary book that anyone today could actually pick up and read and find themselves in. That's a bold claim. But in terms of the books in the Bible, I think it serves that function. And I think that would, the impulse that's in Koheleth to question, to think of life as a gift, but to realize that doesn't inoculate him from serious question or prevent him from leading an unsettled, questioning approach to matters of faith and devotion. That impulse you can find in some of our best writers, in some of the great Christian literary classics. You know, I'm a huge fan of George Eliot, a huge fan of Octavia Butler, and all those points in between. They too belong to the tribe of Thomas. There's something about my own life, as ordinary as it seems to me, which kind of resembles a kind of wandering catechumen. If we had more time, I'd explain what that means, because I trained for the Baptist ministry in the United Kingdom, became an ordained British Baptist minister, served as a theologian in residence in a Southern Baptist church, spent a lot of time actually at Thomas Merton's Trappist monastery in Kentucky, and slowly but surely converted to Catholicism in 2013. And all sorts of reasons for why, but I tend to find Graham Greene's, who also converted to Catholicism in my hometown, actually. I find Graham Greene's observation, it's wonderfully British because it's full of dry humor. Greene used to say, I consider myself a Protestant in a room full of Catholics and a Catholic in a room full of Protestants. And there's something about that that stayed with me, right? There's the nonconformist free church dissenting Baptist tradition that is very much a part of my soul. You'll never get rid of it. But there's also that sacramental imagination, that deep reverence for the Mass. It is, for me, the source and summit of the Christian life. All of that comes together in a person who is not afraid to prowl at the edges of belief and unbelief. The problem sometimes is that I doubt my disbelief, right? And I'm see myself as a kind of wandering catechumen, and always probably will be. It's no coincidence that I took as my confessional name when I converted to Catholicism the name of Saint Augustine, who probably is the best of all the wandering catechumens in Christian history.
Well, I think that's a great title for yourself, actually. And I find you an exemplary figure in the field, Darren, for your work and for your example. I'm grateful that you're in it. And thank you for being on the podcast. It has been a real delight. I've loved this.
Thank you, Matt. It's been a sheer joy to be with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Kate Thorpe. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.